lot at one time.
They were.
And they probably weren't getting any place, so they reduced their role to just interviewing candidates at during the candidacy period, you know. And it's really stupid, you know. That, you know, that's why I wouldn't join them. You know, I couldn't. What on earth do I care about the candidates? You know? I don't mean to say it in the sense you haven't got that on, have
no.
you? Yeah. What I mean.
First, during that early period in Greenwich Village, what your attitudes and beliefs were about sexual freedom, which was one of the other big important
uh-huh.
issues
yeah.
in that point. Wasn't
well,
it?
I've always had an attitude towards sexual freedom. I've always had it. Not necessarily free love. You know, you think in terms that love should be free. But nevertheless, in favor of it, for the very reason that engaging in free love was considered an immoral, puritanic issue. It was so puritanic, it was so false, you know. I couldn't accept it that unless you were legally married, you were not a moral woman. So naturally, in those days, we used to talk about the legal prostitute or the legal prostitute, that a woman would marry a man for money, so therefore she was a legal prostitute. And I was very much opposed to that, you know. And of course, I also believe that women should work, you know, after the marriage, you know, and that would give them more independence. And if they wanted a trial marriage, they could try it, provided they had sufficient knowledge about contraceptives, you know. See, two issues that bother me very much in this free love business. One is getting pregnant, the other is getting a disease, you know. And that people, that girls especially, have no right to engage in it if they are not properly trained, if they are not educated in those two issues and how to prevent them. I mean, that they have no right to sexual freedom with that kind of ignorance. Yeah. And this is my idea about sexual freedom. I've always had it, you know. I mean, there's never been any period in my life that I got it and another time that I didn't have it, you know.
Because that was certainly a contrast, though, to your background, wasn't it?
It was not a contrast. It was part of my background. My whole background from childhood was a radical background.
But didn't your mother have rather Victorian attitudes?
Well, she had a Victorian attitude towards sex, but she just hadn't overcome her mother's training about sex, you know. So she turned it on me, and it took me years before I found out how children were born. And I was so mad at her for lying to me that I went home and gave her quite a lecture. She was in tears. She said she thought I would learn. I said, where would I learn? She says, constantly, it was dirty. She says, how could you and father do a dirty act? How can you convince me that you are doing a dirty act? I thought it was sex was an unnatural act. And she said, well, I thought you'd find it out in the street. I said, I did. But look, I was already 15 at that time. That's a pretty old age, you know, to find out about sex. And I says, I did. I just did. And I'm bawling you out for telling me lies my whole life. And she started telling me lies when I was 4, 5, 6, you know. You know, you see things, you hear things, you know, children are very curious. Oh, they're rabidly curious. You know. And I found that out when I grew up and had contact with children. They're awfully curious. They have years of quietude, you know. They're not concerned with sex. It doesn't occur to them. And then it breaks out again. But the first years of their life, they're very interested in sex. Then from maybe 6 to about 11, they are no longer interested in sex. Then they begin to wake up again. And it's to what extent the lies that parents tell their children bring on that amnesia, I don't know, that amnesiac period between 6 and 11, I don't know. But I had no amnesia about it, you know, about it my whole life, and that's why I was angry at my mother for telling me lies when I had to have the truth. The truth would have been very good for me. So you see that only to that extent. Well, my mother had mixed ideas, you know. And actually, much of my radicalism I learned outside, you know. But I had an I already had a mind that was capable of handling abstract ideas. I had an above normal intelligence, you know. And it isn't that I was conservative at one time and radical at another. I was always radical. When I could begin to think and talk, I talked as a radical. And that was at 12, 13. Maybe before then, I don't remember.
So your association with the radicals, along with everything else, probably helped formulate your ideas on sexual freedom.
You know, my ideas on sexual freedom started before I was 15, when I asked all the questions, was told all the lies, and I began to analyze the whole sex subject in my mind. I would say, how is it possible that men always have loveness if love or sex was abnormal? Is it possible that men are abnormal? You know, I began thinking in that fashion and straightening out my own ideas on it. But I couldn't quite accept the fact that if sex was dirty, my father and mother engaged in it. I couldn't accept that. I mean, I would go so far as to analyze the loveness because the papers were rampant with those stories, you know, especially in those very early years of the century. And so let's see, when you say, when you talk about sexual freedom to me, I had sexual freedom before I reached 15, when I was already rebelling against much of the stuff that I didn't know and some of the stuff that I had already figured out for myself, and I couldn't coordinate them. And I could not coordinate them until I found out that sex was not only normal, but that without sex there would be no human life. And this I was able to grasp very quickly. Within 1 year, I developed so rapidly that everybody remarked about it. And I could not have developed without a brain, without an unusual brain. I'm talking now, in a sense, philosophically. I am not talking politically or economically, but I'm saying that my philosophy, my philosophical attitude was of a nature where I had to analyze ideas, and I couldn't analyze them from one point of view and shut out the other points of view. When I analyze capitalism, I analyze it from both sides, from the point of view of Marxism, from the point of view of capitalism, because I couldn't understand socialism otherwise. I wouldn't know what happened to I would say that capitalism was evil, and I certainly don't say it. Capitalism is not evil. Capitalism is a misfortune because it has outgrown its usefulness. I mean, capitalism today is a misfortune, but capitalism was very necessary at one time for the development of the economy and technology of our society.
Well, Ernestine,
So what else do you want to know?
What do you think has happened to women since that very early feminist and suffrage movement? What kinds of changes do you see, if any?
Oh, I see changes, especially since the women's rebellion 6 years ago.
Before then, did you see any changes?
Well, before then, it seems that the... Well, I tell you, before then, the only fight was in unions. See, the union women were the only ones who were really fighting, and that was almost an economic issue. But I do not remember. See, I've been a member of the union for many years. I do not remember discussion of feminism amongst them. I really do not remember that. I don't recall discussion.
So until the new feminism...
And because it was not a principal issue with me, I didn't raise the issue unless it arose in some fashion. And then I expressed my views, and to my knowledge, none of them criticized me or disagreed with me.
So
a lot of the members liked me, and they liked my ideas, and they liked the way I thought, and so on.
So really, until the new feminist movement, you don't think that women, generally in society, changed much in terms of the roles that they were playing?
Well, I think so, but you see, when you live through periods, you don't see the changes unless they're very violent. And actually, the feminist movement today started out violently and has been violent throughout. And I don't mean that they fought physically, but they did fight intellectually, and also their persistence in changing the stature of women and changing their image in society is very sharp today, to an extent where men cannot ignore it any longer. And it's comparable to the fight for woman suffrage in 1918. It's really quite comparable
well,
to that.
Why do you think that
Except
the
that
early movement failed, the early feminist movement, in terms of really changing women's status and role?
Well, first of all, they, you see, when you ask me questions about my feminism, I had a very wide concept of feminism, the voting right was only a minor right to me, because I was something of an anarchist, and I had no faith in a capitalist society. So what did it matter whether I voted or not? And what did it matter whether a man voted or not? So that's why it wasn't a major issue with me. And I think that that what happened is that they put so much importance in the vote for women that when they got the vote, they felt like they've had a victory, a tremendous victory. Well, it was a tremendous victory, but it was a one-issue victory. And that one issue was not enough, you know. Through the votes, they should have had all kinds of civil codes changed, you know. And in some states they did. As a matter of fact, the common property laws were changed in many states. I don't think it's a national, I don't think it's a federal issue. I don't think it ever became a federal issue. And there have been a number of other rights that women have gained. The major ones, like for instance in the economy of our country, women are so underpaid in similar work with men that it's a disgrace. You know, I mean, it's a disgrace. You can't think of it any other way except as a disgrace. I can't think of a stronger word to use. And today there's so many needs have arisen, you know, like childcare. Because where both parents work, the children have to be left someplace. And there is no satisfaction in hiring somebody to take care of the children. Those children could be spoiled that way. That actually, having contact with their own age is much, much more preferable. So you need child care. Now, whether the parents can afford the child care has been the principal issue in that business. But today, what we've discovered is that many women are either divorced, the husband has escaped, or the husband has died, and anyway, many women are the sole supporters of the children, and they have to have a child care center where they could leave them and pay a nominal sum of money for the children to be taken care of while they're working. This is one issue. This is the economic issue. But there is also the social and the personal issue that parents are actually enslaved to their children. And it's good neither for the children nor for the parents. You know, they're in bondage. The moment they have a child, they're in bondage. Redefine the word responsibility. To what degree are they forced to be responsible? Should they be responsible? And both of these issues, you know, the degree and whether they should or not be responsible, is a part of the bondage system that parents have been forced to for as long as they lived, as long as the human race came into existence. It was easier in tribal days where all the parents took care of all the children. You know, I mean, that the children were the responsibility of the whole group. But today, children are the responsibility of a single group. And it's not even a group. I mean, two people cannot be called a group. But they're the total responsibility of two people instead of a tribe of about 30 or 50 people.
You don't feel that any of these issues were kept alive, though, after that early struggle?
Well, they fought for them. Alice Paul fought for this amendment, for the Equal Rights Act, ever since the voting rights were won, because the voting rights didn't give them equality. There were many areas of not only employment, but in society, in education, in politics, where women were quite restricted, and you couldn't tell whether they were capable of learning or not capable of learning so long as those areas were closed to them. Now, the voting rights didn't quite grant them the right to run as a candidate for some political job. And it was years before women timidly entered the political field. And only today we notice that they're aggressive about it. But women have been very timid about their rights for many years. And it was surprising that the states went so far as to vote for them in 1918, 1920. You know, the men, I think, didn't want the repetition, didn't want a continuation of the struggle, the female struggle for voting rights. And they feel the same way about the Equal Rights Amendment. They don't want it becomes corrosive, you know, this idea of equality. All right, so you have equality, now what else do you want? And this is only the beginning of the struggle for women. No, they have to fight for equality in specific areas, you know, and it's going to be a fight for as long as they live. For as long as society exists, women are going to fight for their rights. But so will men fight for their rights. Men are also they may think they are superior to women, but they are certainly in bondage to. Not only economically and politically, but socially. You know, you're in bondage if you're not free to make a certain decision, or if you are brainwashed all the time. And we are brainwashed all the time. Even the most intelligent of us are brainwashed. So that fighting for freedom is a very esoteric phrase, you know, see? Because then you ask, well, what freedom? And can we endure freedom? You know, you're really going to very abstract questions regarding freedom. But what women have to fight for are the specific needs of herself as a human being, not as a sexual object. And whatever she gains, men should also gain. If she gains something that men do not have, men are entitled to the same. A game. like, for instance, the protective rights for women now in industry. Well, men are entitled to it. Men have always been entitled to it. They didn't get it, but some industries have established them, you know. They're very effective, like coffee breaks. They have them. The only thing they don't have is how much bundles, how heavy the bundles should be that your job demands you should lift.
Well, Ernestine, do you think that we were in any different position 6 years ago when the new movement began than, say, when you went to Washington and when the feminism battle was raging?
You can't compare the two. You really can't. There are two different... They're in a sense different, because that was just simply one issue that was won. Just one issue, the voting rights. And actually the struggle that began 6 years ago had many issues in it. The Equal Rights Amendment is not one issue, but it's an issue with about 15 clauses in it. And you know that the women will have to fight for each clause one at a time.
Would you think that men's attitudes towards women have changed since the 20s?
I think so. Oh, yes.
In what ways?
Oh, yes. Well, they realize that women have been discriminated against in jobs, in education, in even the attitude that men have that women have no brains and should stay in the kitchen. And, you know, there is amongst the more intelligent men a change in attitude towards women, because whatever we know has been instilled in us from our parents and from society, schools, newspapers, streets, organizations we belong to, and so on, and that they have been very prejudicial, extremely prejudicial, and the realization that prejudice is a very bad form of thinking has struck men as well as has struck women. But mind you, it'll always be a minority of each sex that will fight for any social gain, never a majority. The majority will win by default, and they will benefit from them, like the vote. You know, women think that women always have the vote. They don't know. You know, when this came up at the NOW meeting, and it was discovered that I was one of the suffragists who spent 30 days in jail, you have no idea. You know, afterwards, those women came to me to shake my hands, and two young girls, of all things, came over. They were just so grateful for what I did for them. You know, I didn't realize how little is known of the voting rights, how they were won, you know.
Well, it's not part of our history.
It's part of our history, but we don't know the history.
Right.
You know, that history isn't taught in schools.
Well, that's the thing I talk about.
Yeah, that's suffrage to today's fight.
See, there were in those days, like yourself, a lot of women who were feminists in the much broader sense, and yet
that all
disappeared.
Well, I don't know.
Or it all
I don't think they disappeared. I meet women, I know women now who have very much my attitude towards it. And you see, amongst the radicals, you'll find a greater tolerance for a more universal concept of feminism than we had 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And even amongst the conservative women, you'll find an acceptance of the fact that discrimination is quite widely affecting their lives or their development.
Now, in those early days, did the radical men call themselves feminists ever?
I don't remember. And as I said, feminism is a new word.
Well, it's not really.
Well, it was then. To me, so far, I don't even remember the word feminism. See, I remember the word suffragettes. That's what I was called.
Mm-hmm. You don't remember using the word feminist in those days?
I probably did, because I was a feminist. I was a feminist in a much broader sense than a suffragette. You know. As I said, the voting rights didn't mean anything personal to me, but they were a part there. That the women in this country were not all, were quite justified in fighting for it and in demanding them.
Now, Ernestine, what about the flappers?
Well, I don't know that. The flapper came during the 20s.
During the 20s. Now,
I don't remember.
Did those women really represent any kind of new freedom for women? Or
I don't think so. I don't know. Flapper was something that was attached to them because they flapped. I don't know why. Really, I don't know the definition of flapper. Do you know?
No, I'm not really sure.
The 1920s.
And
the Charleston, for instance, is one of their symbols. You know.
Well, and there was supposed to be a whole new sexual freedom of women involved, and they bob their hair, and I just don't know.
Well, maybe flapper.
More than
well, flapper, I think, was not a very flattering term, if you ask me. As I look, as I think of the meaning of the word. And but that men were not very flattering to women when they wanted to designate them symbolically as a part of a generation. So at that time they had flappers. Now I don't know what they were during the 30s, except very poor.
But you don't, I mean, the people that you associated with, the flappers weren't
used. We didn't use them in our crowd.
And they weren't viewed as people who were really striving for some kind of freedom for women.
You see, you know, freedom for women was something that existed all my life long. Every year of my life, freedom for women was an essential necessity, and but it was a wider issue than just one specific one, like the voting rights, like the same pay for the same type of work for both sexes, and so on. It meant getting rid, most of all, of men's attitude that women were an inferior creature, while they leered at them and wanted them, you know. How on earth could they leer and want an inferior creature? I used to think in those terms, you know. And so that there was never a period in my life that I would forget about the freedom for women. I mean, freedom for women also meant political freedom, economic, social freedom, educational freedom. It meant all,